Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I don't know what most white people in this country feel. I can only include what they feel from the state of their institution. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
You're listening to Black History for White People, a podcast where we educate, resource, and challenge white people about black history. I'm Brad, and on today's show are my co-hosts Katina and Garen. Today we interview Harry Eady, who is the director of the Denton African American Scholarship Foundation. You've heard this several times over our episodes, but we always give money to a black or brown owned organization or business. And our first 10 episodes, we wanted that to be the Denton African American Scholarship Foundation. So we talked to Harry about what the foundation is, what the money's going to be used for. He's also the founder of the Denton Black Film Festival. So we talk a little bit about the intersection of those two organizations. And we also discuss education within the black and brown community. We hope you enjoy the discussion.
All right, so we are here with Mr. Harry Eady, who is the president of the Denton African American Scholarship Foundation, and he is the founder of the Denton Black Film Festival. Hey, Harry.
Hello, how are you doing this morning, Katina?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Are you going to sing to me this morning?
No. But I'll do one of those virtual events at the Film Fest.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk about, like, because when I think about you and Miss Linda, I just think about, like, black excellence and everything that you all are bringing to Denton, because there is definitely, like, a drought here when it comes to a focus on black arts and creativity and innovation. Not that it doesn't exist here, but it's not mobilized and it's not acknowledged. And you guys, you and Miss Linda and your team, which I'm a part of, I'm so blessed to be a part of, you help to mobilize voices in academics for the Scholarship Foundation, like bringing just highlighting our kids in Denton, who, and there are many who have who basically exceed academically, but also, like, the way the film festival, thousands of people come from all over the literal world to this festival, and how we started off with, you know, what was the first year's attendance?
800.
And then last year, this year, it was
8,900.
Yeah, and we have celebrities coming from all over the world. I mean, it's like crazy to be rubbing elbows with people that you see on TV and all these amazing filmmakers. So let's roll back. First, we'll talk
to your
about
point,
I
talked to, I don't know how many people have seen Lovecraft Country.
Yes.
Well, I talked to one of the actors in Lovecraft Country yesterday.
Shut up.
Yeah.
I love that show so much.
And so I didn't know that, but she was in the scene in Oklahoma. She played the mother.
Oh, yes.
Where the house caught on fire.
Yes.
And so her name is Regina Taylor. So that was pretty interesting conversation.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Okay, so I don't know how we're going to get all this in an episode, because, one, you have such an amazing life and just so many amazing stories, and just how you navigate for Denton, and just, like, in representation of our culture. And I mean, there's so much, there's so many layers, but let's start by talking about you a little bit, your story. Who is Harry Eady?
Yeah, so I grew up in North Carolina, and a little small town, 12,000 people, and I always felt like I was not in the right place, right? Because things were a little slower. I was really curious. And so I was a first-generation college attendee and went to school in Indiana, a little small school. Then later came to Texas to do graduate work at UNT. So it's really been a life of discovery for me. And so I've been in the business world for, you know, 30-plus years in the computer and software industry. But, you know, my heart was always in the arts. I spent a lot of time with artists when I was in school, even though I was a business major. So almost all my friends were in the arts, right? And so that's really kind of a synopsis of kind of, you know, how I got to Denton from Indiana and then, you know, started to work in the Metroplex. Actually never worked in Denton. You know, I worked all over the country, but never worked in Denton. I lived here, but, you know, that was it.
Yeah, because you travel quite a bit. You're always on the go. So talk to me about, like, what prompted you to get so active in Denton? Like, is that something that have you always served or had a desire to serve, like, the community in the way that you do? Has it been something that's, like, been a gradual thing? Like, what's gotten you to where you are as far as the service?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I grew up in the church.
Yes.
And so service became a part of me, right?
Absolutely.
And, you know, and then when I went to college, I noticed that there were a lot of needs, right?
Yeah.
And so then I started realizing that I could potentially support people. So I never really sought to be a leader.
Yeah.
I just sought to kind of be in organizations. But over time, I began to take on leadership roles, and which is kind of interesting because in college, I mean, in high school, I would have never been considered a leader.
Really?
Not at all. I would have been probably voted least likely to succeed, right?
Wow.
And so part of that was quiet.
Yeah.
But when I went to college, I just said, I'll just be who I want to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so then later I decided that if I could serve, I would serve. And so that's what I did. So my really thing is I love people. I love working with people and just trying to figure out how to help people.
It's so interesting that you talk about you would have probably been voted least likely to succeed, because that's a whole thing that I think deserves a pause. So many times, and I can identify with what you're saying for my life personally. Mm-hmm. I mean, I excelled academically, but I was also quiet and shy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting how Black people, so many of us have these experiences, especially as we exist in white spaces, where if we're not entertaining people, mm-hmm. if we're not outgoing, and when I say entertaining, I'm talking about on a personal level. If I'm not making you laugh, if I'm not, you know, making you feel good about yourself, if I'm introverted, if I'm quiet, like my middle son is so extremely quiet, but he's a straight A's, all honor student, but he's just quiet, unassuming.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not that funny Black guy that everybody can say, I have my funny Black guy friend, or if you're not a problem, or, you know, someone that they would want to criminalize and deem a problem, then it's like you automatically do not fit. And that's crazy to me because there's so many, like, Black people that have that story that have gone on to do amazing things. And I'm not talking about America's measure of success. I'm talking about, you know, our measure as a culture, like what we deem successful, starting, you know, small businesses, serving their community, being leaders in the church, just filling those voids and meeting those needs in small ways and big ways. But there's so many of us. I mean, I can think from like Beyonce to just somebody who nobody knows their name that have that same exact story. And it just makes so much sense that you would just be a part of this environment that fosters, like, just basically fosters encouragement for Black youth. So talk about that a little bit more.
Well, you know, again, that's a very good question. I know that when I was younger, I was smart, really smart.
Yeah.
But I was really quiet, very shy. I wouldn't talk to anyone. One of my high school teachers pulled me over one day and he said, you know, you're really a smart guy, but no one would ever know it, right? Mm. He said, because you don't want people to know it. So there was a part of me that was lazy, you know. I didn't really want people to ask me questions, right? And so, but then I realized that if I, you know, if I didn't really try to be the best person that I could be, then I would suffer, my family would suffer, and my community would suffer. So it was a process, right, to kind of figure out, okay, what do I want to do? I also grew up in a community where there was segregation, right? You know, in small southern towns. And so I never really thought about it because I had a very supportive black community, right?
Insulated, kind of.
Yeah, so when I went to school, it was like, it was an all-black school, grades 1 through 12. And when I tell people that, they're like, what? You know, it's one building, right?
Okay.
You know, but it's, you know, a small town. But then in the seventh grade, I went to an integrated school. And that was a major shock, right?
Yeah,
a major shock for me. And because, you know, I went from being the majority to, I think there were out of maybe 800 students. No, I'm sorry, maybe 500 students. There were maybe seven black students in that middle school.
Wow.
And we all knew each other because we all came from the black school over to the other school.
Yeah.
So it was really trying to figure out, you know, how do I find my way, right? And I think that's really what a lot of students have trouble with today, regardless of ethnic background. I think high school is brutal, personally.
Yes, and middle school for sure.
Yeah, and so you see children change a lot when they go from elementary school to middle school. And my son did, my daughter did. I'm assuming most people do.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, it's really been a challenge for me to kind of retrain myself, you know, which I think most of us do.
Yeah, so talk about the Scholarship Foundation. Give us a little bit of history and just tell us how you came to to work with.
So there was a, the scholarship organization is 36 years old.
Wow.
Entering its 36th year. It was started by a few people through the NAACP. Eileen Brock was one of the people that were there. She was asked, along with two or three other people, to start an initiative to provide money for students. So the first grant was, first scholarship was $250 to a young lady that I knew. And then over the years, we've awarded over $400,000 to black students to graduate from the Denton High Schools. So the largest year of scholarships has been maybe 24,000, 25.
Wow.
And then, you know, we're averaging right now around 15,000.
Awesome.
And the funds really come from organizations like yours or individuals, right, who we've been talking to for a number of years. And unfortunately, you know, many of them have and are dying, right, because they're, you know, they're older now. And so that's what has made the scholarship organization so powerful, because it's just people giving freely, right?
Yeah.
None of us are paid in the scholarship organization. So I was tabbed about 13 years ago by Eileen and Fran Morgan to become the president of the foundation. There was a scholarship committee that selected the students, and we just really, as we found out later, raised money for them to give to the students.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of what happened. And so today, you know, we're doing quite well. We are working really hard to support students in a powerful way. We had the scholarship announcement back in April, May, and we were socially distanced. We were able to do some of it. But we awarded 7 students this year. With around $15,000.
And Rachel Owusu-Odeyi, she was the primary, the primary scholarship recipient this year?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. Okay, I'm looking at the
and
wrong
then
years.
This year, we have not loaded that up.
Oh, okay.
Okay, her name is Adeo Ajudo, And she's attending Columbia University this year. She's there now. And she's going to major in global health and biology, or biology.
Oh, wow.
And so she's outstanding. She finished as a valedictorian at Denton High School.
Yeah.
So we're really proud of her. We not only do we award graduating seniors, but we also award 9th, 10th, and 11th graders with a recognition for the academic achievements.
Oh, really?
and some bond. So so we do that as well. And so 9th, 10th, and 11th graders, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you know of anyone and they're doing that,
I have a sophomore.
They need to be aware of that.
Absolutely. How I ain't know that? I don't even know how I ain't. I didn't know that.
Yes.
So yeah, I love what you guys are doing, or what, you know, I'll say what we are doing, because,
right.
You know, I'm so blessed and fortunate to kind of work alongside you and serve. And I just love that here we have something that's been going on for 36 years, you know, that spurs our African-American students on,
mm-hmm.
and specifically focuses on the Denton High Schools. I know some of the recipients through the years. There was a young lady from 2016 that graduated with my oldest son. Her name is Adenawa, and I've known Adenawa since she was in elementary school, and just saw,
mm-hmm.
I mean, this little girl in the fourth grade writing poetry and just blowing my socks off. And I'm like, you need to marry her. Like, when you, because this girl, she's got it going on. And she ended up going to Howard. Now she's in, Harvard.
Right.
She ended up going to Harvard, and now she's, looking at in graduate school.
Yeah, she's in graduate school, my understanding, in public administration or public health. But she should be almost finished by now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, she's about 22.
She was accelerating her academic studies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. And she was a Denton High School student.
Harry, let me interrupt. I think maybe a lot of our listeners are probably like, they're probably thinking, why does there have to be a scholarship foundation for African Americans?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think maybe some of them are questioning why is that even a thing? Why can't there just be scholarship foundations that, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit of why a foundation like yours, mm-hmm. even has to exist?
No, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think the fallacy that we all have is that we're all equal. And we're all treated equally. So so that's been a question that people have asked. And so my answer to them is that there are scholarships for everybody. So no one is forced to provide scholarships to really any scholarship organization. It's really based on the needs. I know I was at UNT one time, and there was some funds given to albino squirrels. And I thought, is that a thing, right? Well, it was a thing because it was actually an albino squirrel at UNT, right?
Yeah.
And so they were just giving money. But I would say the primary thing, the reason why it's important, if you take a look at, if you go to any of the ceremonies at the high schools, you'll find that almost none of the students of color receive scholarships. It's just a fact, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you sit in the audience and you look at those coming down, you may see, oh, I'd say three, maybe two, maybe one. So with the exception of the scholarships that are offered by the foundation, it is very minimal, right? But yet, you know, students of color, black students in particular, they are worthy of receiving awards, right? And so I think there was a statement made years ago, you know, you need to help yourself, right? So the interesting thing is when people try to help themselves, they're criticized because, well, why are you separated, right? So what we try to do is say, you know, we're going to try to help those students that have qualified. We're going to give them a scholarship. What I also find interesting is that their scholarships are given to Jewish students,
mm-hmm.
Latino students,
mm-hmm.
Asian American students, and for the most part, nobody even says anything. But when it comes to black students,
right.
There's an outcry, well, why do you have to separate? And so it's not an answer, but it is really some thoughts around that. I don't really criticize anybody for giving scholarships to anything, as long as, just my personal opinion, if it's for something positive, right? I don't believe in, you know, supporting things that are hateful, right? And putting people at risk where they are, you know, they're not going to be good citizens, right? But,
right.
You know,
go ahead.
I've got, like, you kind of brought up two things, and we brought up this in the podcast before, but one is, I think, you know, I don't, like, the disparities between white kids getting scholarships and black and brown kids not getting scholarships, I think you have to come up with an idea in your head of why those disparities exist. And to me, I'm going to always simplify it to, you either have to think they're not smart enough to get the scholarship, or they don't work hard enough, or you have to think that the system that's giving scholarships is not equal. Which brings me to my next part is, like, even when you talked about integrating schools, I think what's interesting about that is, I think a lot, for a lot of white people, even myself, I just imagine, like, the students aren't racist. So I always picture in my head, all the white students, all the black and brown students aren't racist. And, like, almost like nobody's racist in the whole process. But I think what we have to assume is, like, we kind of give a free pass for all the teachers and administrators at these schools that were integrated, that, again, they are not this neutral system. Like, our whole, like, society was systemically racist, and we can't just think that our school principals, administrators, teachers, that are, like, some of the most important careers in our country, like, we can't just assume that they're outside of this bubble that doesn't have, you know, racial biases towards students. So I think it's just important to remember that no one's free of this.
But, like, we've seen that in Denton. I mean, Denton has Robert E. Lee Elementary School. One. Two, Denton has a very sordid history with racism. But also, like, there was a teacher or principal at an elementary school that was found out to have been in the alt-right and wrote a book. Remember that? About the alt-right. And it went under the radar for so long. And he had this successful book, and he didn't get called on it until, like, way after the book was written. We've had a principal at Denton High School, where my sons attend, that used the N-word, and it was caught on film. I mean, we, as a black community, like, we know and feel those disparities. We have disparities in the school to a prison pipeline. I've seen that with my three sons. My middle son, he exceeds academically, but I had to push for him to be a part of the junior honor society at the middle school that he attended. And I had to ask, like, hey, my son, you know, is in Expo, which is the gifted talented program. He has perfect conduct and straight A's and all honors classes. Is there a process? Do y'all have a junior? Do y'all have an honor society? Yes. 3 months it took for the teacher to respond to me, and I had to get another teacher involved. And then 3 more months, nothing. Like, he was like, your son seems great, and I'm going to look into this, and nothing. And then one day I found out that he just kind of slid him into the organization. It was different from my experience at an African-American middle school, where it was like, hey, you got these grades, you're a great student, you're in the honor society. And my son was the only black student, the only black male, which I think is so interesting in how he was, you know. And so academic excellence is something that we have to foster with our kids, because a lot of times they're not even acknowledged within the school systems. They get, you know, they get kind of just shoved down. Because it's almost like an offense sometimes to white teachers and administrators that a black child could be smart. And there are so many stories where black students will say, you know, and from your generation especially, where it's like, well, you can never be XYZ because you're a Negro, because you're black. And I'm like we were talking about before the podcast, before we started filming, is like, you know, all these people that have lynched people and, you know, committed racial hate crimes from the 40s, 50s, 60s that are still alive, that have never been brought to justice, and they've taught their children hate. And yeah, hatred infiltrates every aspect of our society, especially education. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, but I think, you know, to get back to, continue your thought, but also to talk a little bit about what Brad asked. I think that's really an important question, right? To find out why these things exist.
Yeah.
But I think what we found, and I think statistics will show this to be true, it really starts in the home.
Yeah.
You know, and so we don't start off racist. In fact, you know, one of the things that I really want people to think about, the definition of racism is been misused. People are misinformed about racism because most people don't really know what racism is.
All right.
Okay. So racism is the exclusion of a race or group of people from the mainstream of society. Definition, right? But most people, they call each other racist, but they're not. So in America, I can't, as a black person, I cannot be racist. I can be prejudiced.
Right.
Because I can't exclude people from the mainstream of society.
Exactly.
So I think what people have to, and we talk about that really at the festival too, so people have to figure out where their power exists. So if you know that I have, I was in a foreign country once, a guy in South America, and some of my friends, we were there for like a Peace Corps program, and they were white, right? Well, the little kids that were there wanted to touch them, wanted to rub their hair, wanted to, you know, just feel them, right? And so it was really offensive to my friends, and they said, why are they doing that? I said, well, we go back to America, that's exactly what happens to me. And they said, oh, yeah. I said, but what happens is you're not in the majority here, right? And he said, yeah, you feel so comfortable. And I said, of course, I'm with my people, right? I'm, you know, because the country was 49% black, 51% East Indian, right? So I think that we really have to understand what racism really is. And so another data point is that only 1.5% of all businesses in the United States are black owned. Mm-hmm. The population of black people is 14%. Mm-hmm. But you only have a 1.5% business owners. And most of those are beauty salons, barbershops, funeral parlors,
restaurants,
you know, barbecue places, right? And so what can you, if you think about it, what can you buy with 1.5% ownership? You can't buy a John Brown thing, to be honest with you. You really can't, right? So you got to really think about that. And when you say someone is racist, you got to say, well, do they have the power to exclude me from something, right? Well, the answer is, if you're talking to most black and brown and Asian communities, the answer is no.
No.
You don't have that ability, right?
Yep. So if I can just jump in with just kind of like a little walkthrough, real brief walkthrough, some of the history of exclusion of black people from education. I think it's like maybe helpful for the listeners, bringing that into the conversation. So going all the way back to the slavery era, black people were forbidden in all the slave states. Oh, yeah. Black people were forbidden from getting an education, from mm-hmm. learning to read and write. Mm-hmm. And part of that was because for the white, the idea of white supremacy hinged on this inferiority of black people. Mm-hmm. And so white people knew, like, the only way we are justified in enslaving all of these people is because we believe we're better. Mm-hmm. And, like, it was this, like, they had to make black people less than fully human in order to have, to get their conscience to work and allow them to do what they did. And so then they forbid black people from getting education mm-hmm. and protected their ignorance. But then the very fact that the white people were forbidding black people from learning to read and write proves that the black people were able to mm-hmm. and proves that they wanted to. Mm-hmm. So it's not even really a good justification of white supremacy, but that's what they did. Mm-hmm. And then after slavery ended, the process just continued. Like, white supremacy did not end when slavery mm-hmm. ended. So white people all through Jim Crow put up all kinds of obstacles mm-hmm. to black education. Mm-hmm. To where, just like one snapshot, just to give you guys, the audience, an idea of what this looked like. In Alabama in the 1930s, the total salaries of teachers instructing
8,500 black children was 8,000. The total budget for 2,000 white children, so a quarter of the population, like the white kids were only a quarter as many, and their budget was 60,000 instead of 8,000. So like the per student funding for white kids to get educated was just astronomically higher. Black teachers were paid generally between somewhere 30 to 40% as much as white teachers. And so like the history through Jim Crow is just like a massive underfunding of black education. They also shortened the school year for black kids because they wanted to just have them work in the fields longer. So the black school year at these segregated schools would only go for 6 months. And then there's like the quotes. Alabama state legislator J.L.M. Curry said education would spoil a good plow hand, and he said that to the Alabama General Assembly. Wow. It's just this idea of like the white supremacy, like white people all throughout that era of history not only didn't see the potential of black people to contribute to society by becoming educated and actualizing their full potential, but they deliberately tried to suppress that in order to justify white supremacy and in order to just stay in control of society. And then moving like into the present, like segregation of schools, you know, as like you said, you were at a school that was segregated, and I assume that was after Brown versus Board. Brown versus Board didn't really end segregation. It just like, honest, it wasn't really fully enforced to where it just kind of faded out slowly. And then there's still today a massive funding disparity between schools that are predominantly black and schools that are predominantly white. And white families have, on average, 10 times the wealth of black families. So when you're speaking of the need for scholarships, like there's just a greater financial need for black families. Also, I think on the idea of just implicit bias that Brad, you were getting into, there's I've heard that 3 to 4 times as many black children receive detention as white children. So like even just like starting at the very early age, like black behavior, like when black kids are acting up, it's not seen the same way as when white kids act up. Even if they do the exact same behaviors, there's just this implicit bias where teachers will treat it differently or interpret it differently. And that, starting at like elementary age, just continues all the way up through. And just the one other anecdote, we're doing research for a future episode on Malcolm X. And I just think Malcolm X, he was a top performer when he was in middle school and up into high school. He was like at the top of his class. And then he had one of his favorite teachers ask him one day what he wanted to do, what he wanted to become. And he said he wanted to be a lawyer. And the teacher just kind of laughed at it and said, you have to be realistic because you're a Negro, is what he said. Mm-hmm. And Malcolm X was so like knocked off of, like he basically that kind of sent his life into a spiral for the next decade. Mm-hmm. And eventually he went to prison and got through it and like got an education, but he basically gave up on the whole education system because of that single comment. And that is, I mean, multiplied a million times over, like the things that African Americans face in the country as obstacles to education. So I think with all that history and context now today, for you to be doing something that's pushing back against all of that and starting to like bring equality. And I think it's only ignorance for white people who say like you're increasing inequality by giving black people an advantage. It's just like the only way you can think that is by being ignorant to the history and how we got here and what the picture is today.
Yeah, and I think some of that really has, I mean, those are really good thoughts, because part of it is the primary reason that the festival exists is really to do two things. It's really to share black culture and build community, right? Because what we find is that people tend to stay in their own spaces, right? So if I'm black, I stay in a black space. If I'm white, I stay in a white space. Hispanic, blah, blah, blah. Everybody stays in their space, and what So about 20 to 22% of our audience is non-black. So we have really a lot of avenues for people just to come and talk, right, and share. And what I find is that when you put a name to a face, then you have an ability to begin to communicate. But most of us tend to look over the fence and say, well, wonder what those people are doing, right? And they become they. But all of a sudden you say, oh, it's Gary now. So then Gary's talking to Harry, Harry's talking to Brad, Brad's talking to Katina. Now we have a relationship. So what usually happens is people throw things over the fence, right? And they never talk to people. And so I think that's really why you see racism so prevalent in really throughout the world, right? Everything is just based on race, right? In other countries, it's different things. They have caste systems, right? But it's all meant to exclude, you know, a group of people.
So let's talk a little bit more about the film festival. How you guys got started, how, you know, the vision, and sure. just how you got started, and those, you know, beginning years, first year versus now, and what your goals are and what your vision is for next year, and some of the hurdles that COVID-19 has presented. And
Good question. So the film festival was started. My wife and I attended the film festival, and while we were there, I said, wow, you know, we were looking for ways to raise money. As I said earlier, is that a number of people were dying off, right? And so I talked to the board about the fact that, you know, we needed to do something to kind of raise money. And so I told them I thought the film festival idea would be good. They looked at me and said, okay, we don't understand this, but, you know, we'll let you try. So we began. The first year we had, in a day and a half, 800 attendees. Next year we blew up. We tripled in size. We went to over 2,400. And Denton only has an 8% black population, right? But we started, as Katina said earlier, people from all over the Metroplex started attending, right? Because we had just invitational films. And so fast forward that to last year, we moved from a day and a half. We're only 6 years old. We're going into our seventh year. We had 8,900 attendees. We were in 12 venues. People from all over the world came. We're one of the largest black film festivals in the country. And I say that we are really a cross between South by Southwest and Sundance, right? So we're moving toward incubation for filmmakers, but also we're a multidisciplinary platform in that we offer not only film, that's our anchor, but we have spoken word, comedy, really a lot of things that are prevalent with black culture, right? And so we just try to share those things in a very positive way with the community. Katina does some things with us vocally and in comedy. So, you know, we're really important. Her children have helped. Son has helped. I mean, husband has helped. They do the comedy for us. So it's really been a great experience, I think, for people to just kind of enjoy it for 5 days. This year, we're going to do a hybrid festival, so we'll do something in person, hopefully do quite a bit virtually because of COVID-19. And so the goal really is to, I think, do some amazing things. We're going to have a couple things that we are trying out in dance, and then also poetry, not just spoken word, but traditional poetry. And then we move to year-round programming, which is really kind of helping us.
Well, and what's so interesting about the Denton Black Film Festival is that there's so much inclusion. Many of the filmmakers, some of the filmmakers are white.
Asian. Latino.
I mean, and it's just been amazing to see a black film festival basically display what any film festival, you know, or any organization that's, you know, just the inclusion that's there and really giving a voice to voices that are not, that have been, some of the voices that have been rejected by the mainstream, giving people a platform and a place to exercise their gifts. It's been amazing. So talk about some of the artists and the filmmakers that that have come.
So we have filmmakers that are world-renowned. Last year we had Jasmia Horn,
yes,
who's a two-time Grammy-nominated jazz vocalist and performer. The year before that, we had Kirk Whalum.
Yes.
And Kirk Whalum is arguably one of the top jazz saxophone players in the world.
From Memphis, Tennessee.
That's right, from M-Town. Memphis. So we've had him. This year, we had in our offseason Nikki Finney, who is a poet laureate. So we had her. We just had another, and we hope to have him not this year at the festival, but maybe the coming year. Chester Higgins,
yeah,
who is a photojournalist,
yeah,
who did a lot of work with the New York Times, Look magazine before it went under, several things. So, and then from a filmmaker perspective, we just have a number of talented filmmakers from all over the world, primarily independent filmmakers.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we're moving more toward, as I said, things in with other creatives. We're hoping to do some things. We also have things in visual arts. So Annette Lawrence, mm-hmm, is a UNT, well, she was a UNT professor. She just graduated. I mean, she just retired, and she's doing her own thing. But she's really phenomenal. She's known internationally. Mm-hmm. So we're really happy to have her as our director of visual arts.
Wow.
But she's here, and then so we're going to have two great art showcases this year at the festival. And then a lot of music, a lot of film, and the Tech Expo is going to be pretty amazing this year.
Yeah, we've had artists from The Voice. We've had, you know, some of the, yeah, more mainstream black artists. Tommy from the Martin Lawrence Show.
Yeah, forgot about Tommy. Yeah.
Rest in peace. We've had Mama from Soul Food, the movie, which,
yeah,
is like
a Hall.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, I'm saying the characters' names. Yeah. But people know, you know, Mama from Soul Food. Like, she is, you know, some of these movies that are cult classics within the African-American community. And then the mom from Family Matters. She was at,
yes,
yeah, I mean,
yes,
we've had, it's amazing to see celebrities that for us, for our community, that are so, they're big to us, you know, they're, mm-hmm, you know, they're in some of our favorite movies and shows, and they've been right there, you know, shoulder to shoulder with us at the film festival in little old Denton. It's been amazing.
Yeah, so your memory is much better than mine. I forgot about all this. Yeah, but it's been really phenomenal to get the entertainers and filmmakers at the festival, and we're hoping to continue to grow that.
Yeah.
So we're gonna put links to information about the festival and about the Scholarship Foundation on the show notes for the episode, and also we'll send some of those out through social media.
Good.
I just want to encourage the audience to jump in to support these initiatives. We have raised through Patreon and through some outside donations, we've raised $2,000 that we're going to give to the Scholarship Foundation. So we're going to get you that money today.
Oh, man.
And then also just want to encourage the audience, anyone who maybe you haven't jumped onto Patreon, but maybe just hearing this and hearing the need for scholarships, if you want to give, then we'd encourage you to find that link through the show notes. And let's just rally around this cause and be generous and help students become who God made them to be. Especially, I mean, I think just how critical of a point in life it is, a student on the brink of going to college, and to say, like, we believe in you, and you can do this, and,
yeah,
and you can get on this whole trajectory and path towards towards building up the world around you and making it better. So we want to rally around that.
Yeah, so I just want to say one thing. If I would just encourage all of you to go find someone that you don't know of a different ethnic background and just have a conversation. I would encourage you to come to the film festival. It will be virtual, a lot of it, so you'll be able to see some things in the confines of your own home or your own space. But seriously, if you want the world to change, just go meet different people and get to know them, and then you'll find out that we just have a lot in common, right? Mm-hmm. But we have so many barriers and obstacles that we think prevent us from seeing each other.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're looking for more information on what we discuss, take a look at the show notes or go to blackhistoryforwhitepeople.com. If you'd like to play a supportive role in the podcast and be able to vote for future topics, check out some behind-the-scenes video footage from us, and even get a chance at getting a custom Black History for White People coffee mug, check us out on patreon.com/blackhistoryforwhitepeople. All of the money that you give in the next 10 episodes will all go to The Witness. The Witness exists to make sure Black Christians are equipped to flourish through education and philanthropic endeavors to meet the modern challenges of Black Christians today. On our next episode, we will be discussing Malcolm X. We'll leave you with this quote from Nikki Giovanni. It is not who you attend school with, but who controls the school you attend.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.